And with that, please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Chris B. from ASPCON Speakers Group, ASPCON, New Jersey. You can sit.
Good evening. My name is Chris Bruner, and I'm an alcoholic. My home group's the ASPCON Speaker Group. We meet on Wednesday nights from 8 to 9 p.m. in ASPCON, New Jersey. We're a speaker meeting a lot like this one. We're pretty new. We only started a couple weeks ago. At our first meeting, we had about 80 people, a lot of young people, 18 to 30, and enthusiastic, pumped up. Our group is the Three Legacies group, so we actually have a home group member whose job within the group is to contact hospitals, institutions, and places like that, so that way we can get out and into those facilities. And we also invite those facilities to come out to our meeting, and we've had a few of them. They're letting us pick guys up and bring them out to the home group. I'm grateful to be here tonight. My friend Bill over here just reminded me the last time I was out this way and spoke. It was a couple years ago, and I was getting ready to turn myself in to do some prison time for some things I'd done prior to my sobriety date. So I'm happy to be here. My sponsor tells me that gratitude, like love, is an action word, and I show my gratitude in Alcoholics Anonymous when I bring new guys out with me. So everywhere I go, I got a carload of new guys, and we got some guys over here that came out with me. And I have a sponsor. I think more important than just having a sponsor and name, my sponsor knows that he's my sponsor. You know, there's a promise in the big book on page 100 in chapter 7, Working with Others. And what it says is, it says that when we put our lives into God's hands, that his plans for us are far greater than anything we could have come up with on our own. And I've come to believe through my experience that that's the job of strong, God-inspired sponsorship, is to guide me through a series of actions that enable me to have a spiritual awakening so I can have conscious contact with God. And I've come to believe that anything that promise is true, anything God has planned for me is far greater than anything that I could have planned for myself. My sobriety date's October 19th, 2010. I don't have a lot to do with that, but that's the day that I was separated from alcohol and all mood and mind-altering substances. My story begins in Omaha, Nebraska in 1979 when my parents met. They met in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, probably a lot like this one. And, they were young, and, Bill Wilson writes about it in the 12x12, boy meeting girl on AA campus, so I suppose they kind of looked at each other across the room, their eyes met, locked, and, love at first sight, right? And that would be a great story if they both would have stayed sober, but they didn't. They both got drunk shortly thereafter, had me. Be careful if you're new here tonight and you see somebody across the room and you think it's love at first sight, because what you may end up with 33 years later is me standing up here talking about my resentments. So like I said, neither one of them stayed sober, and they got divorced shortly thereafter. And my father remarried, and I come from a long line of alcoholics. My grandfather was an alcoholic. My uncles, aunts were all alcoholics. I watched my grandfather's brothers die of cirrhosis of the liver, and if anyone in here has ever watched someone die of cirrhosis of the liver, it's a very painful way to go. Your skin turns yellow and gets tough and jaundiced, and your eyes turn yellow, and not only is it like sad to watch, because spiritually you watch someone, you're watching someone who's been dying for a long time, but also physically it's a really tough thing. Some of my earliest memories, I remember when I was a little kid, probably 5 or 6 years old. My grandmother was the only one in my family who didn't drink. And my grandmother, she was a real good woman, a church-going woman. She was Catholic, went to Mass every day, and worked. Tried to provide for her family, was loving, kind, caring. Around Christmas time, my grandmother, she'd get her house decorated. It looked beautiful. She'd have the Christmas tree up, lights outside, Santa Claus, all that stuff. And underneath the tree, there were always presents, and they were wrapped up. And I remember 3 or 4 days before Christmas, me and my cousins are underneath the tree, and you know, we're shaking the presents, trying to figure out what's in them. And you know, leading up in the couple days before Christmas, you can start to smell food cooking in the house, and the night before, pies and stuff like that, and the aroma of cinnamon and apples. And there was a lot of anticipation leading up until Christmas, and everybody's really excited because the whole family's going to get together. And here comes Christmas Day. So on Christmas Day, the whole family comes, starts piling into my grandparents' house. And in the morning, 9, 10 a.m., everybody's giving each other hugs and kisses and saying how great it is to see each other. And it's been a long time, too long. We need to do this more often. And the men go in the living room and they set up a card table and they start drinking. And you can hear the beer cans pop. And they start playing poker and they start gambling. And me and my cousins, we'd go in the living room in the morning. And when we're going in the living room, you know, our favorite uncle's pulling a silver dollar out from behind our ear and stuff like that. And by noon, these guys, they're starting to lose money. And a lot of the smiles are gone and stuff like that. And, you know, that friendly hello starts to turn into, what the hell are you doing in here? And, you know, and by the afternoon, the whiskey's coming out. And once the whiskey starts coming out, that what the hell are you doing in here starts to turn to get out. And by dinner time, it's just a mess. And, you know, people are yelling and screaming, you know, fighting. And everybody's leaving early before dinner. Christmas is ruined. I'm going home with my little brother, my stepmother, and my father. We get home and my stepmother and my father are yelling and screaming at each other and they're fighting because my dad lost the rent money. And all of a sudden downstairs, I'm upstairs in my room and I start hearing, you know, you can hear dishes breaking and stuff like that and the voices are getting louder and it's a scary thing as a little kid. And then you can start to hear the two of them and they're fighting and they're coming upstairs and I'm crawling underneath my bed and I'm hiding underneath the bed and I start praying. And I'm saying, God, please help me, you know, please take me somewhere else so I'm not around any of this. And all of a sudden that fighting spills over into my room. And you know what? This God that I'm praying to that I really can't feel, nothing's happened. He hasn't done anything for me. And the only thing that I could take away from that, and it talks about it in the chapter We Agnostics, this childlike view of God that we have when we get sober. The only thing I could take away from that is if there is a God, he doesn't want to have anything to do with me. And there was something else that I took away from that and from those family events and those family experiences. I saw that alcohol seemed to have something to do with the craziness and the madness that went on in my family. And I promised myself something from a very young age. And my grandmother, she'd take me to church with her and we'd go to church and she'd make me promise her. She'd say, Chris, promise me you'll never drink because if you don't drink, you won't end up like your uncles and your grandfather. And I'd promise her and I'd say, I'm never going to drink. Never going to drink alcohol because I see what it does to everyone in my family. It seems to destroy them. I went to Catholic school, and in Catholic school on Wednesdays, we'd go to Mass. And when we go to Mass, we'd go in and we'd kneel down. And I remember I'd try to pray with my classmates and stuff like that. And I was just like, from a very young age, you know, I started to like already feel disconnected. And I would pray and I wouldn't feel anything. And I'd want to believe in God because I was told that it was important. And I wouldn't feel anything. And I kind of felt disconnected from the people around me. I felt disconnected from the people in my classroom. I was always a little bit restless, irritable, and discontent. And that all changed. I remember when I was in sixth grade, we'd moved, and I lived with my parents and my little brother, and we lived in Geneseo, Illinois. And in Geneseo, Illinois, right down the street from us, there was an old canal. And this canal was it was shut down. It was a historic like landmark and a really beautiful area. And I used to go down there and there were trails and stuff. And me and my friends, we'd ride around on the trails on our bikes and stuff like that. And me and my buddies, we came up with an idea. Our idea that was that we were each going to, you know, once a week, we're going to take a couple beers from our parents and we're going to put them in a book bag. And then we're going to take these beers down to this canal and we were going to go and drink and see what happened. And I remember after I'd filled up my book bag and my buddies had filled up our book bag, it was a fall afternoon, and we went down, we rode our bikes down to this canal, and we went down to the canal, and I remember it like it was yesterday. And I remember I cracked open that first beer, and I don't remember if it happened with the first beer or the second beer, but at some point I looked up, And like it was like I could see like the sun setting, and I could see the trees, the leaves changing color, and everything was beautiful, and everything was all right. And all that fighting that was going on at home, and the craziness in my house, and not feeling like I fit in school, it was all gone like that. Something had happened in that second. I believe that's what makes me alcoholic. It wasn't the things that alcohol did to me. It wasn't ending up in penitentiaries. It wasn't ending up running the streets, and it wasn't destroying. What alcohol did for me was it seemed to make everything okay right here, right now. And it allowed me to live in the present for the first time in my life. All that anxiety that I felt was gone. And I felt okay. And I remember that night when the sun was going down, this girl Rachel, the prettiest girl in school. And I was always afraid, my desk was right across from hers in school, like I was afraid to talk to her, and that night we kissed. And I was able to talk to her. And I remember going home that night, and I felt like I was on top of the world. Until the next morning. I woke up the next morning, and by the time I was in sixth grade, page 151 talks about these four hideous horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And I felt that even worse at that point than I'd ever felt it before, because that magic that I'd felt the night before was gone. Around the same time, I was getting into some trouble in school. And the principal decided that it'd be a good idea if I went to go and see my first doctor, my first psychiatrist. So I go to see this doctor, and this doctor decides that I have attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity. Gives me Ritalin. I think the only thing I took away from that experience was that I wasn't a huge fan of speed. I liked what alcohol did for me a lot more. As I went into high school, I started to drink every chance I had on the weekends, going to keggers and stuff like that. And, you know, that magic that I'd experienced that day in that canal was recreated over and over, and I started to get into some trouble. Something really profound happened when I was when I was 15 years old. My dad went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. For the first 2 years, my father was sober. My father got significantly worse. He was always a violent individual. But he got worse sober. On my 16th birthday, my father got arrested for domestic assault sober. But then there was something else that happened when I was 17 years old, and I remember it like it was yesterday. My father had ended up sober in a mental health facility. He was losing his mind. He ends up in this facility, and he gets out, and he meets this guy named Steve. And Steve's a close family friend, and he's my father's sponsor to this day. And Steve believed in this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and he started taking my dad through the steps as they're outlined in that book. And I remember I was 17 years old, and my father asked if he could take me out to dinner. We go out to dinner, and when we come back home, we're sitting in the driveway of the house, and my father made amends to me that night. I later found out that my father had gone out in a couple days span, and he cleaned up most of the wreckage of his past, and he started to get current with his amends. And I want to tell you, there was a transformation that happened to my dad. In that instant, he went from being an angry, violent person to probably the kindest, sweetest, gentlest person I've ever met. My father's sober 18 years today, and he actually had a sponsee recently who asked my mother if he ever drank. By this point, I was pretty confused. I was starting to get into some trouble. My father didn't want me to go down the same path he'd gone down. He sent me to my first treatment center. I went to Hazelden in Minnesota. I spent 28 days in their primary care program, and I spent an additional 90 days in their extended care program. While I was there, one of their psychiatrists went and had diagnosed me as having an antisocial personality disorder. I was put on a lot of medication. That's just slick talk for sociopathy. And they were probably right, because I've come to, at the time, I didn't really have any empathy for other people. I didn't care what happened to other people. And I'm sure I've come to believe that a lot of the symptoms of untreated alcoholism are pretty similar to sociopathy. Into my 20s, what I would do is I'd usually date like a nice girl, and usually a girl that was going to college, take her hostage, usually had her things together, from a good family. And I noticed something. I noticed, like, these kids that, like, you know, these girls I was dating were going to school with, they were able to go out and drink and kind of do what they wanted, and nobody asked too many questions. So I decided to go back to school. And so I go back to school, and in my early mid-20s, I graduated from college with a degree in business administration. I did pretty well. I graduated summa cum laude with 3.96 GPA. And I want to tell you something. I still, at the time, I would wake up in the morning, and I would still experience those hideous four horsemen, because that's when the book says we feel them upon awakening, when I'm sober. And I would still feel them. But because I was doing well in school and stuff like that, I felt like maybe my life's manageable, because I really didn't know what this deal was all about. I didn't know what this spiritual malady was, this feeling of disconnection from God and from my brother and sister. So what I decided by that point was I wasn't an alcoholic. After I graduated from college, I had to figure out what to do next. By this point, my drinking was a pretty constant thing. I wasn't really functional enough to hold down a full-time job. I wanted to keep the school thing going for a little bit longer, so I tried to figure out what I could do. So I settled on law school. I got accepted to quite a few law schools, and I ended up settling on Rutgers in New Jersey. And in 2007, I moved to the state of New Jersey, and I started going to law school. The only problem was that I brought myself with me. I did pretty well in law school academically, but man, my life was like coming unhinged. I'd met another one of these girls hostage, so, you know, I did the only reasonable thing. We got engaged. In my third year of law school, I was involved in some things, some extracurricular activities to help finance the way I like to live and what I like to do my extracurricular activities. So, in my third year of law school, I'm drinking pretty much constantly by this point. Drugs have become a part of my story. Out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll tell the truth. I was on a three-year heroin run at the time as well. And I'm driving through Camden one day, and I get in a minor car accident. Task force runs down on my car, and they find a loaded handgun in the third seat of a Dodge Durango next to a little glassine baggies for manufacturing heroin. I get arrested and I get taken to the Camden County Jail. Now, I was in my third year of law school at this point studying for the bar, and I want to promise you one thing. I knew the trouble that I was in probably far better than anyone else in that jail. And I knew I was watching my legal career get flushed down the toilet. I call up my fiance at the time. I give her the name of an attorney. I give her a combination to a safe. I ask her to contact the attorney, set up a bail bondsman, go into the safe, get the cash, pay the bail so I can get out the next day. I bond out. The only instructions I had when I bonded out, my fiance had told me that the attorney had asked that I go directly to his office. And I knew I needed to go directly to his office rather than go to his office. I walked into Hank's Bar off 3rd and Market in Camden, New Jersey, and I ordered a shot and a beer. And I sat in that bar for the rest of the night, man, and I felt a sense of ease and comfort in that moment. The indictment, problems in my life, everything else, it was gone, man. I didn't even think about it. A week after that, I'd met with the attorney by this point, and he told me that he's like, Chris, you better slow down. He said, there might be a chance we can get you out of this. He said, I doubt it, but you got to slow down. He said, you're headed for a lot of trouble. A week later, I got busted in North Philadelphia in the Badlands, and they call them the Badlands for a reason. I got busted on the corner of Reese and Indiana. Guy called me up and asked me if he could purchase some dry goods. And I went to make the delivery, and when I made the delivery, the FBI pulled up. I get arrested again. I'm charged with interstate possession with intent to distribute CDS, heroin, and cocaine. I uh, call up my girlfriend, we go through the same song and dance. My fiance, we go through the same song and dance. And I bond out the following day. At this point, I know that I'm probably going to prison. I also know that I'm hot with law enforcement. And I know that things are only getting worse. I walk out of the 24th, 25th precinct in North Philadelphia and I catch a cab to a bar off 3rd and Indiana in the Badlands. I walk in and I order a shot and a beer. And I sat there for the rest of the night. All the knowledge that I had about what deep trouble I was in meant nothing. All the fear I had about the trouble I was in meant nothing. Because I knew that as soon as I drank that shot and that beer, everything was all right. Even if it was only temporary. And that was the truth. On September 7, 2010, by this point my fiance's gone. Her parents had intervened. They'd sent her to a treatment center down in Florida. I'm living in a beautiful luxury loft by myself. And my fiance's gone. I'd been contacted by my law school saying that I was suspended pending a disciplinary hearing. They were interested in some of my extracurricular activities. The state police and law enforcement contacted them as part of an investigation trying to find out what I was into. And I start going through my cell phone. And I'm going through all the contacts, and I probably had 300 or 400 contacts in my phone, and I'm looking for somebody I can call, somebody I can reach out to, a friendly face or a friendly voice, and I don't see any. And in that moment, I felt completely alone and completely out of options. I run back through my phone, and I see my dad. By this point, my dad was 18 years sober, and I gave my dad a call, and he said, He answers the phone, and I told him I was in pretty deep trouble, and he said, I know, son, I know you are. And he said, I love you. And he said, I'd do anything I could to help you, but he said, at this point, there's nothing I can do but pray for you. And he said, I'm going to pray that you find a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and that you walk into that meeting and that you get honest with the people in there. And he hung up the phone. And at that point, I was probably at the best point any alcoholic could be at. I was out of options. The book tells us alcohol is a great persuader, and at that point, I believe I'd been persuaded. And I called AA Intergroup and I asked them where there was a meeting. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and they told me the only meeting around at that time was at 315 South Fifth Street in Camden at the Last Stop Clubhouse in Camden, New Jersey. And I told the Intergroup guy on the other end, I said, I don't think you understand. I'd prefer not to go. Is there a meeting in Cherry Hill or somewhere else? And he said, son, you're looking for a meeting, and he hung up the phone. So I went into that meeting, and when I went into that meeting, it was a big book meeting, and I really don't remember what anybody was talking about. I don't remember what they were reading. What I do remember is the guy walking up to me, giving me a cup of coffee and a pat on the back. And after the meeting, these guys said to me, we're going to another meeting in Philly. Would you like to come with us? I didn't have anywhere else to be, so I told them, all right. I go with them to this meeting in Philadelphia, and I remember when I went in there, I said I was a newcomer, and all these people came up, and they were giving me hugs. There was a friendly face. The friendly face was in here with you. I was at the last stop a couple days. I asked a fellow to sponsor me. I was there 6 days, and on my sixth day there, a kid came in that I knew from the street. And the thing was is that the state police were looking for me in New Jersey. They hadn't seen me for a while, and I wasn't calling my bondsman to check in like I was supposed to. And This kid was a confidential informant, and he left, and he went and contacted the state police, let them know where I was at, and maybe an hour or two later, the Philadelphia Police Department showed up. And they showed up, and I went outside, and I talked to these guys. They asked me what I was doing there, and I told them I was trying to get sober. And I'm not sure why, but after about 20 or 30 minutes and they were going back and forth with New Jersey, they said, "Son, why don't you go back in there and keep doing what you're trying to do?" So I walk back inside, and the next morning I wake up, and I don't know, it was like I had this much breathing room, and I still really hadn't taken any action, and that thought came, this time's going to be different. You got a week sober, you got to clear your head a little bit, it's going to be different this time. And I hit the door, and I went back out for the next 30 days. And when I was out there, I'd seen something when I was at the last stop. There were a lot of guys in there, and they were going through the steps, and they had big books open and stuff like that, and that really hit me. And it's funny because I was in a speaker meeting really similar to this not that long ago, and there was a kid in there that I used to run with, and we used to drink together. And he remembers calling me up, and I was telling this story, and he started laughing. Guys were calling me up to go out, and I was telling them, "Hey, you know what? There's a way out. There's a solution. Have you guys heard about this big book?" Now, I'm saying this to guys that I'm drinking with and running with, and they're all looking at me like I'm crazy. But there was something that happened when I was there. I'd seen some hope. So 30 days later, I call up this guy that I'd met when I was there, and I tell him I'm willing to do anything he wants me to do. All I want is help. He comes by. He picks me up. And I go with a little duffel bag to a recovery house in North Philadelphia, and I start detoxing. And let me tell you something, if you've ever come off of a 3-year heroin and benzo run, it was a hell of a detox. And booze. So I'm detoxing, and on my fifth day there, this little 21-year-old kid from Cherry Hill comes into the house. And he says, "Why don't you take a walk with me?" And he walks with me up the street. And the only reason I went with him is because I was afraid if I didn't, they'd kick me out of the house. So I walk with him up the street. We walk up the street, and we sit outside on the front porch. And while we're sitting outside on the front porch, he starts following the directions directly out of a chapter working with others. He starts asking me about my story, getting to know all he can about the new man. So I start telling him where I was drinking at and what I was up to. And he starts telling me that he used to go to a bar that I went to. He'd go with a fake ID, but he still went to the bar. And I started to identify with this kid, and he started talking about the way that he was feeling and the way that he'd felt sober. This kid had maybe 45 or 50 days sober. And by the time we were done talking, after an hour, I was willing to follow this kid anywhere he was going to take me and do anything he told me to do. And he takes me inside, and he takes me into a table in the kitchen of this little recovery house. And he opens up this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and he starts going through the book. And after maybe an hour or two, we get down on our knees and we say a third step prayer in the kitchen of this recovery house, and he gives me fourth step instructions. I go back to my recovery house, and that night I can't sleep, and I start writing. And when I started writing, it was like there was a fire when the pen hit the paper. And I want to tell you, I've gone back through the steps since then, but I've never had an experience like this first one. I've gone back through the steps a lot of different ways, line by line, out of the big book, but never had an experience like this. So I write down every selfish, dishonest, self-seeking thing I'd ever done in my life. And I put it all on paper. It took me about 3.5 hours. And I call this kid the next day and I ask him if he's ready to move forward. And he comes over in that night, and over the course of about 3 hours, he hears my fifth step. By this point, I have maybe 6 days. He hears my fifth step, and in that moment, something happened to me. I started to feel hope, because for the first time in my life, I knew what was wrong with me. For a long time, I'd come into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and like most people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd raise my hand and I'd say, "My name's Chris, I'm an alcoholic," and I had no idea what that meant. And that night, I had an opportunity to find out what that meant. I got to find out that selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of my trouble. Alcohol is just a symptom. And when this kid's done here in my fifth step, he sends me back to a room in this recovery house to spend an hour alone, to review the first 5 proposals, spend some time with God. And I go back into this room, and in the big book, it talks about under the fifth step that, you know, we'll begin to have a spiritual experience, and that was my experience that night. I go back into this room in this recovery house, and when I go in there, I hit my knees and tears started flowing down my face. And let me tell you something, the way that I'd been living for a long time, crime wasn't something that I was used to doing. Tears started flowing down my face, and I started begging God God, can you please help me live differently? Can you please help me be a different person? And I spent that hour alone. Next day, he goes over the sixth and seventh step with me. And I go out and I start making amends. The guy that had taken me to this recovery house comes and picks me up and takes me to an Oxford house in Cherry Hill. And I move into this Oxford house. At the time, my license was suspended, and I was told that it's a spiritual principle. If you don't have a license and you don't have insurance, you don't drive a car. And this guy that took me over to this Oxford house sits down with me, and he reads the big book with me line by line. And as we go through this book line by line, paragraph by paragraph, page by page, through the first 164 pages, we're sharing our experience as it relates to what we're reading, and that book had a heartbeat. And I had started to have experience with what was in that book, so I'd read this book previously, but all of a sudden it's like magic, and it all starting to make sense. At 25 days sober, I went on my first commitment to Maryville Treatment Center, and this guy told me to get up there and talk. So I got up there and I talked. Afterward, a kid comes up to me and he says, "How long have you been sober?" I said, 25 days. He says, "I got more time than you." And I said, "Yeah, but I'm leaving." Within my first couple weeks, I went on my first 12-step call. I was told I had to get into action right away and start helping others. So I remembered that spot, the last stop. So I started taking the bus from Cherry Hill to Kensington every day. I'd go and take the bus to Camden. In Camden, I'd go and hop on the Patco. I'd take the Patco to the L, and the L to Kensington and Somerset in North Philadelphia, and I'd get off at the train station at Kensington and Somerset, biggest dope block in North Philadelphia, and I'd walk with my big book in hand because I felt like I was protected. That's a promise. That's a promise, right? Get placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. Felt safe and protected. And in fact, I 12-stepped the guy that was selling needles. And I'd walk down to the last stop, and I'd take guys through the steps. And that was a really magical time for me. And I began to experience complete and total freedom. I began I got to feel happy, joyous, and free. I started sponsoring guys, and I started taking commitments, and I started getting active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know this fellow, I heard him speak one time, and he said something that was really powerful. He talked about different types of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and you got big book guys and you got fellowship guys. But he's like, you know, a lot of them that stay sober have one thing in common, and that thing that they have in common is they make Alcoholics Anonymous a way of life. It's probably easier if we go through the steps, since that way we know how to practice principles in all of our affairs. But, so we make Alcoholics Anonymous a way of life. At a little over a year sober, those legal problems didn't go away, and I believe something. I believe that just because I get sober and just because I go out and I start doing God's work doesn't mean that all the things that I did that I don't have to pay consequences anymore. I believe that there is a promise, and what the promise is that I don't ever have to go through those things again. But they don't just go away. So I walk into a courtroom in Camden, New Jersey to be sentenced by a Superior Court judge. And when I went in, I wasn't alone. The courtroom was filled with people from AA. And people from AA had written letters, probably 30 or 40 letters. And I go into that courtroom, and the judge sentences me to 3 years with a one-year mandatory minimum in state prison. Which was probably a blessing, because when they were first coming at me with numbers, it was more like 10 years with a five-year mandatory minimum. But I got to go and do a little bit of time, and I walked out of that courtroom, and I was handcuffed, and I looked behind me, and I saw my sponsor behind me, and I saw guys from AA behind me. And I knew I was just going to be a tourist. I was just going to be a visitor. But I believe something, and it talks about it in our third step. I have a new employer, being all-powerful. And the deal is that my job is to go out and to do his bidding and to do his work. And if I do God's work, God will take care of me. You know what? That's what we talk about like in that third step contract, right? If God takes away my difficulties, I promise to go out and bear witness. I'm going to go bear witness to my brother and sister and share the good news of what's happened in my life. So I went to jail with a purpose. I walk into the Camden County Jail. You go downstairs and they strip search you. I'm in this little room naked and I hit my knees and I asked God. I said, "God, do with me what you want. Show me how to be of service." And he did right away. I get taken upstairs the next day in the Camden County Jail, and I get put into 7-day lockdown. While I'm in 7-day lockdown, I'm there one day, And a guy comes in, and the guy who comes in is withdrawing from alcohol. He's an alcoholic. And I sit down with him, and we sit down, and I start sharing my experience, strength, and hope for the sole purpose of recovery. And we had a lot of time to talk, so while we're sitting there talking, I hear his inventory, and they give you these little postcards, and on the postcards, he starts writing amends letters. He talks about it in the big book. And after 6 days, I leave that facility, and I go to Craft in Trenton, New Jersey. I'm in Craft, and when I get to Craft, I did the same thing. I hit my knees and I asked God, God, please show me how to be of service. I'm there one day, I'm walking out on the yard, and this guy's walking on the yard with me, and he tells me he's an alcoholic, and he's been trying to get sober his whole life, and he hasn't been able to. In the yard of that jail, we got down on our knees, we said a third step prayer. A couple days later, I heard his fifth step. We did the same thing with the cards, and he's sending out amends letters. Shortly thereafter, I get transferred to Bayside State Prison in Leesburg, New Jersey. Bayside State Prison, I'm behind the wall in this lockdown in this penitentiary, and my bunkie, his name's Nick. I start talking to Nick when I get in there, and I find out Nick's an alcoholic. God kept putting people in front of me to be of service to. So I start sharing my experience, strength, and hope with Nick. And inside that penitentiary, we started taking guys through the steps. And in the morning, we would have a morning meditation. And in the afternoon, when we'd go out on the yard, we'd have little big book studies. We'd sit there and we'd do AA inside that penitentiary, just like I do out here. Cool thing is, one of those guys got out recently, and I've been able to start taking him out and showing him his family out here. It was pretty neat because I was at a speaker meeting kind of similar to this, and the director of one of those facilities was actually in the meeting, and he heard me tell my story, and he was able to sit there with a smile on his face, and we talked afterward because he'd watched all of this, and it was a pretty special and powerful thing. And what I learned in that moment, what I experienced in that moment, was that I don't need a phone list. I don't need to go to a meeting every night. I was properly armed with the facts about myself, and with guys getting high around me and drinking homemade booze around me. And look, when you're locked down with somebody, there's nothing you can do about it. People, places, and things, that's not really something you can move away from. But I was properly armed about the facts, with the facts about myself, in this program of recovery that's located in the first 164 pages of our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was all I needed to stay sober and to stay happy, joyous, and free inside of these facilities. When I was in Bayside State Prison, I was talking with Nick one day, and we're watching all these guys sitting around with big books. And he goes, man, this is pretty awesome. And he goes and he tells me something that was really powerful. He said, Chris, I'm freer in this moment than I've ever been in my entire life. He's saying that behind the wall of a maximum security penitentiary. And I look back at him and I said, me too. And I believe that's the power of God. And I don't get to know God by myself, but I get to know God with my brother and sister. And I get to experience God with my brother and sister. Locked down behind the wall of a penitentiary, I got to experience that. When I went up for parole, I got released on parole. I'm currently on parole right now. I got out February 21st. Of this year, and I want to let you know, because I do believe that it's important to follow instructions. I'm not supposed to leave the state of New Jersey without permission, so my parole officer knows that I'm here tonight. You see lights outside, it means I did something I wasn't supposed to. So I get out, and I get paroled to this sober living house in Absecon, New Jersey, which is where I live now. And I got down there, and I felt kind of weird, because from the first day I'd gotten sober, I was placed in positions where I was able to constantly be of service to other people. And I was a little bit jammed up, because I kind of felt like these people down in this area weren't doing AA quite right, and they weren't behaving the way that I thought that they should. Getting a little bit jammed up, and my sponsor drives down, and he said, Chris, what's going on? We talk about it, and he said, you need to go out and find ways to be of service and to get into service. So I go out and I start going to the local clubhouse. I found some commitments. I found commitments at in a couple of facilities down there. I start going into these facilities and I start going into the local clubhouses and I start finding guys to sponsor and to take through the steps. And what happened was really cool. I got to start to see a fellowship grow up around me. And it's been a really awesome experience. I was able to, I got a job. I was also asked to manage the sober living facility that that I was living in. And the cool thing is you know, all the guys that live there, everybody's going through the steps. Everybody's a part of the home group. Everybody's staying sober. There's only been one person that's relapsed in the last 5 months, which for new guys in any type of sober living environment is amazing. And I don't take any credit for that. I believe God's written all over that. You know, we're just used as instruments. And then I'm able with some of these guys to start this meeting, and we start this meeting, and we actually have our fellowship chair right over here. He's out printing off flyers, and we're going around. We've got a bowling event coming up next month, and we've got all these young people involved. And we have the speaker meeting, and we've been talking to a church. We're going to start a big book study that kind of coincides with the meeting, and we go out to commitments and stuff like that. And we also have fellowship things to do, so that way everybody gets to feel a part of. And the cool thing is, like I said, at our first meeting, we had 80 people. And a lot of young people, 18 to 30. And they were hungry for this. They were hungry for what we were doing, being able to experience a new way of life. And it's just been such an amazing, amazing experience. And you know what? I go to work, and I got a boss that absolutely loves me. I know that because he tells me. And trust me. And I mean, I'm a guy fresh out of prison, and this guy trusts me. And it's because I believe it has something to do with the fact that I go to work and I look for what I can do to make my coworkers, my boss, and our customers' lives a little bit easier. What can I do to make their life easier? That's why I go to work. I go to work with primary purpose to treat everybody that I work with like they're a newcomer, and to see how I can be of service to them. When I go home, I do the same thing. And it's been an awesome ride so far. And you know, I want to tell you, sometimes I get to experience entire periods where it feels almost like bliss. You know, and riding up here with these guys tonight, and I feel like sometimes that's like the real meeting is before the meeting when you're traveling there. And, you know, we got 2 hours in the car together, and we're getting to know each other, and we're talking. And on the ride home, and I get to experience these periods where I'm not thinking about myself, what I want, what I need, what I think I need to be okay, and where I'm able to focus on what I can do for other people. And I get to feel like just a complete feeling of bliss. Felt that in a prison. I feel that out here. Sometimes I get jammed up. Get a little bit jammed up. And, you know, the nice thing is our book, it gives us a response to our alcoholism. It gives us a response with, with our 10th step. There was a fella in Alcoholics Anonymous who I'd had a pretty strong resentment toward. Really didn't have anything to do with him, had a lot to do with me. I was able to inventory that. I reached out to a guy in Denver, went through the inventory with him, and, 10th stepped it. And I found that, I was kind of treating this guy, I was putting the same expectations or ambitions in our third column on him that I would on God. I was expecting perfection out of this human. I do that a lot. And, you know, a lot of times I treat people like God, and God like a person. You know, I treat God like Santa Claus and ask him, God, can you give me this? Can you give me that? Can you give me a job, a car, a girlfriend? Blah 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 blah. It was written a long time ago. The same rain that falls on the just falls on the unjust alike, meaning that God takes care of all of our needs and provides for all of His children. And what I've come to find out is I never had to ask God to even get me sober. AA was already here. All I had to do was walk into the rooms and take some action. Didn't have to ask God to get me a job. All I had to do was go out, take some action, move my feet, and put in some applications. God already had the job there for me. God's already provided for all of my needs. It's just up to me to take action and then thank Him for it later. You know, this fella from California told me that spirituality is like the horizon. The higher we go, the farther we see, and the farther we see, the more there is to see. And I've come to believe that that's true. I've also come to be very clear as to what my primary purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous is, and is to share all these experiences with another alcoholic for the sole purpose of recovery. And that when I do that, God takes care of everything else. So long as I'm extending my hand and treating my brother and sister like they're my brother and sister, and I'm trying to drag new people out of the same gutter that I crawled out of, telling them the same thing that was told to me, to follow 3 feet behind me, we'll show you how to live, we'll show you how to thoroughly follow this path. And so long as I'm doing that, God will take care of me. There was a story that was written about 2,000 years ago, and it was about this guy who goes up to this guy, Peter, and he asks him if he loves him. And Peter goes and says, I love you. Of course I love you. And he asks him again, do you love me? And he said, of course I do. I love you. And he asks him again, do you love me? And he says, of course I love you. And he says, well, if you love me, tend to my sheep, tend to my flock. So I've come to believe that if I love God, and love is an action word, just like gratitude, that I show my love for God by going out and trying to be my brother and sister's keeper. By going out and trying to pull my brother and sister out of the same gutter that I came out of. And so long as I do that, God will take care of me and all of my needs will be provided for and met. My life is none of my business and I don't have to worry about it. And what a beautiful way to live. I get to be rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence that's been beyond my wildest dreams. I get to live in the present, in the here and now. What a beautiful promise and what a beautiful way of life. And I'm going to say a prayer that if there's anybody in here that's new tonight, and I'm sure that there's some new people in here, and I'm sure that there's some people in here that have probably been sober or dry a little while that aren't quite feeling this deal, aren't feeling happy, joyous, and free. And if that's the case, I'm going to say a prayer. I'm going to say a prayer that you walk up to one of these people that are in here tonight or myself, and you ask us to show us through our actions how to live. Because there's something that I know. There's something that I've seen through my experience, and it's crystal clear to me. It's that there's no alcoholic that ever has to get loaded again. And not only do we never have to get loaded again, but we can live in this world with complete peace, complete serenity, complete dignity. We can feel happy, joyous, and free. I've come to know that that's what God's will is for me, to be happy, joyous, and free. And there's been a path that's been outlined so that way I can feel that way. So if you're not feeling that way tonight, I'm going to say a prayer that you can get with somebody in here and that you can come follow 3 feet behind us and we can show you how to live. Thank you.